It's good to know you have a good sense of humor, wicked sense of humor. I don't know if you can even say that in the church, can you? Well, good morning. It's great to be here. Our text for today follows a pattern that we've noticed in the last few months. The book of Mark moves fast. It's told with a sense of urgency. Mark wants to grab our attention and help us believe in Jesus because the time is short. And so far, we've seen Jesus do some surprising things, haven't we? He's healing people others have not been able to help. He's making waves in social power structures. And his disciples don't fit the normal mold of rabbinical students of that day. Amazing action is taking place wherever he goes within a growing dynamic of tension. And this sets the stage for our story today. If you are able and you would like to, please join me in standing for the reading of God's word. This is Mark 5, 21 to 43. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out of him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and he went in to where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. The word of the Lord. You may be seated. So this text is two stories in one. It's a story within a story. It starts with one set of characters and then stops to include a new story with a new character, and then it jumps back to the original story. This is sometimes referred to as a Markan sandwich. It's a writing tool that Mark uses more than once in his book. And each story is actually meant to flavor the other, to give the other a deeper meaning. These two stories today conclude a group of four miracles that are set down together after Jesus has told a series of parables that we read about before these four miracles. The four miracles are the stilling of the storm, the exorcism of the Gerasene demoniac that we heard last week, and then today, the bleeding woman and raising Jairus' daughter. It is believed that this is deliberate, that Mark means to display Jesus' authority, one, over the natural world, two, over the spirit world, 3 over the human body, and 4 over life and death. And scholars think that Mark does this to demonstrate Jesus is qualified to say the things he's been saying. So it's as if Mark is saying this, okay, if you're not sure about all these messages he's been giving us, just watch now what he does. Nothing in creation is outside of his authority, and therefore we can trust he's qualified to say what he's been saying and what he will say. And so our two stories for today have something to show us about faith and fear, belonging, family, and the disintegration of social status in the face of God's compassion. And so let's take a look at some of the characters in this story. Our first character is Jairus. Jairus is named. When Scripture includes someone's name, it's important to notice this. Jairus isn't just any man. He's a named representative of the religious establishment. And he has authority in the community. He has access to privilege, power, and security. His position would afford him respect, reverence, and possibly even fear. Jairus would have known exactly who Jesus was. The stories of Jesus' miracles were widespread in the area at this point. And Jesus had already had some tense conversations with the religious leaders because of his critique of them. And so Jairus would have known and possibly been part of the hostility of the religious leaders towards Jesus because of his growing favor among the people. So Jairus' identity, the fact that he is named, is significant. And then there's the woman. Unlike Jairus, she is not named. As a woman in ancient times and in Jewish society at that time, she would have been seen as a lower or less valuable member of the community. She is marginalized by her gender. But she's also marginalized because of her affliction. In the Old Testament, there were purity laws around menstruation, so she is considered unclean when she's bleeding, which is all the time. This would have kept her from being part of her family and the wider community. So if she'd had a husband and children before her illness, she would have been required to be separate from them. And she wouldn't have been allowed into community worship for 12 long years. And if that wasn't enough, she is poor. She has spent everything she has trying to get help. And so these are two very different people. There's differences in gender, education, life experience, and social standing. Anyone hearing this story when it was written in Mark's time would have easily discerned the contrasts Mark's making between these two people. Where they're the same is in their desperation and their belief that Jesus can actually help them. So let's take a look at some of the risks they take in their desperation. First, here's something interesting about Jairus. He's got a soft spot for his daughter. Even though women were less than men societally, her life is important to him, and he's willing to take a big risk in trying to save his little girl. He runs to the rebel upstart Jesus, and he falls on his knees, and he pleads. Now, these are not respectable actions from a man in Jairus' position. It's certainly not in keeping with his status in the Jewish community. So he's risking his reputation and his position of authority. The fact that he comes at all, and in a manner of supplication, would have been a public endorsement that Jesus might actually be who he was claiming to be. That might have made him a little unpopular with his peers, don't you think? Yeah. Notice, though, that Jesus makes no comment about who Jairus is. He could have made an example of him at this point. I know who you are. Tell me again, why would I help you? But Jesus says nothing. He stops what he's doing and he follows Jairus. Jesus' actions demonstrate relational compassion before any physical healing actually takes place. Now, the woman, she takes a big risk because she shouldn't have even been in that crowd of people. But she's desperate, and she's convinced that Jesus can heal her. And as soon as she touches his garment, she feels her body is restored. But her risk doesn't stop there because Jesus outs her. Who touched me? Just like Jairus is exposed by coming to Jesus, the woman is exposed, just not by choice. Now let's pause and notice here too the disciples' response right now. Their tone in responding to his question is a bit dismissive, like, duh, Jesus, of course people are touching you. But you'd think that after being with Jesus the way they have for the time that they have, they might have learned to read his cues a bit better. Hang on, the boss is doing something a little weird. Maybe we should pay attention. But no, they miss it, and like they often do in Mark's gospel. And despite this, Jesus does not give up on his disciples throughout the book. He doesn't go looking for a new crew. Thanks, guys. I'm going to find a new group. He continues to demonstrate his commitment to his students even when they're slow to understand. And I don't know about you, but man, that encourages me because I am slow to understand sometimes. In this case, Jesus disregards his disciples' dismissive comments and he keeps searching the crowd because he is not willing to let this person go. Now, at this point, the woman could have just disappeared, melted back into the crowd, but she risks a second time by stepping forward. She risks the possibility of further shame and negative consequences for touching him and making him unclean. She could have gotten into trouble for making everybody and the teacher Jesus unclean. Like Jairus, she comes and she falls at his feet and she tells him the whole truth in front of everybody. And as Jesus engages with her, he names her. He doesn't ask for her given name. Betty? Betty, was it? Your faith has healed you. No, he addresses her with a familial name that breaks down barriers that have existed for her. Daughter. To be a son or a daughter in any family bestows certain rights, status, affection, belonging, and inclusion. But particularly in Jewish culture at that time, who you belonged to, who your family was everything. And Jesus goes straight to the heart. He welcomes her into his community, gives her status and a place to belong in his family. As one author writes, on his way to heal Jairus' dying daughter, Jesus stops and cares for one of his own. And then he says a funny thing. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. But the story tells us she's already been healed from her physical affliction. Perhaps Jesus is speaking to her deeper suffering, the deeper alienation, because he's not just interested in the practical things of life. Jesus is interested in matters of the heart. Now, as this warm-hearted scene wraps up, we're jolted back to our original story. Someone comes from Jairus' house and tells him, your daughter is dead. Notice Jesus' invitation to Jairus in this moment. Don't be afraid, just believe. Now, fear isn't an emotion I would assume in a situation like this. I can imagine massive grief, can't you? Pain, perhaps even anger, Jairus might have felt, because Jesus' decision to engage this woman, this nobody, has just cost him the life of his beloved child. We aren't told what it is Jairus is afraid of in this moment. Regardless, Jesus sees through to Jairus' heart, just as he did for the woman. And Jairus is now faced with an opportunity to risk again, just as the woman was. And here is the beautiful part where the inner story of the woman informs Jairus' story. Here's the sandwich. Considering the faith that Jairus just witnessed in the woman, can he hold on to his own? The woman who had no advocate, no position, no status, no resources, ends up becoming the example of faith to the religious leader, to the teacher of the community. Now, Jairus could have slipped away at this point. He could have abandoned his faith and his hope. But he does choose to risk again, to take Jesus home with him, even when everybody else believes, this story is over. Waiting back at home for them is another crowd, the crowd of mourners, and their tone towards Jesus is even more dismissive than the disciples was earlier, right? They outright laugh at him when he tells them the child is just sleeping. Jesus doesn't get into it with them. He puts them out of the house and he gets on with the reason why he came. And in this story, it's Jesus who reaches out to touch the one who needs healing. Author Kenneth Bailey notes that Jews would go through rigorous cleaning rituals after coming into contact with blood or dead bodies. The fact that Jesus is not made unclean by physical contact with the woman and the little girl, but is able to restore them both to health, reveals an authority that could only come from God. Jesus proves himself to be the cleansing ritual that people need. Now, it's interesting that Mark chooses to include the Aramaic words that Jesus speaks to the child. Like, why not translate them like the rest of the document? I like N.T. Wright's take on this. He says that the best answer is probably that this scene and those crucial words made such a deep impression on Peter and the others who were there that whenever they told the story afterwards, when Peter tells this story to Mark, even in Greek to non-Jewish audiences, they kept the crucial words as they were. And so it wasn't some magic formula. It wasn't a kind of abracadabra, right? They were the ordinary words you might use to wake up a sleeping child. But part of the point of the whole Gospel of Mark is to show that the life-giving power of God is working through the ordinary details of life. I also like N.T. Wright's translation of the Aramaic, which is a bit different than the NIV this morning. He translates it as, "Time to get up, little girl." It seems tender and playful to me as I hear that, in keeping with how you might actually speak to a child. And here again, Jesus doesn't actually ask for the child's given name, but he doesn't call her daughter either, like he did with the woman. She's a little girl. She's Jairus's little girl. Jairus, the desperate father who risked much to rescue her and has been rewarded. Now, do you hear echoes of another story here? Who else do we know that would do that? What other father do we know who would abandon his position and his status to save his beloved children? This story, within a story, points to God's much bigger story of rescue. And N.T. Wright speaks to this when he answers the question, why didn't Jesus heal more people? Why didn't he raise more people from the dead? There are three occurrences in the Gospels of Jesus raising people from the dead. There's this one, there's the widow's son at Nain in Luke 7, and Lazarus in John 11. But surely there would have been so many other grieving people with family who had died. Why did he not do more? N.T. Wright says that the question actually misses the point of this larger story Mark is telling us. Just as Jesus wasn't coming to be a one-man liberation movement, as the people had hoped that he would be a king that would overthrow Rome, he wasn't coming to be a one-man emergency medical center. He was indeed starting a revolution, and he was indeed bringing God's healing power, but his aim went deeper. These things were signs of the real revolution, the real healing that God was to accomplish through his death and resurrection. Signposts are important, but they aren't the destination. Jesus was on his way to confronting evil at its very heart. He will meet death itself, which threatens God's whole beautiful creation, and defeat it in a way as unexpected as these two healings. There is so much we can glean from these two amazing stories. Here are a few takeaways I'd like to offer us today. The first is that we have a God who listens. He pays attention to us. We see Jesus stopping what he's doing to follow Jairus, and then he stops following Jairus to engage with the woman. Jesus makes space for people to interrupt him, and he listens to them. And this reflects something important about the character of God. Adam McKeown, in his book, The Listening Life, suggests that as a ruler, God has absolutely no obligation to pay attention to anyone or anything. I kind of like that statement. He has no obligation to pay attention as an absolute ruler. But our God astonishes us and completely flips power on its ear by entering into listening relationships with people. The Lord lowers himself to pay attention to an individual's particular troubles, even doing for him or her what is asked. Adam McHugh says, what kind of king is this who would actually kneel before his subjects? Jesus' actions reveal an intimate God who is deeply interested in the details of our lives. He's not a dispassionate monarch. He's a God who's willing to be interrupted, who inclines his ear to listen, who makes time for his children. If God were to come into the room now and kneel down before you, so close that you could whisper in his ear, what would you say? What would you ask? The second thing I want to point out is that it's okay to be needy. This story shows us that we have a God who responds to needy people. And this is good news, because at some point we all have known, or we will know, what it is to have uncontrollable circumstances cross our path. And whether we have status, or whether we're on the margins, whether we're privileged or not, life is unpredictable. We are, or will be, needy at some point. You know, perhaps the dire situations of the people in this story and the miraculous nature of the events that follow seem too otherworldly and not applicable to our everyday life. We could compare our circumstances. You know, my situation isn't that bad. But when we do that, we deny Jesus the opportunity to respond to us intimately and personally the way he does for Jairus and the woman. You know, perhaps we have revealed need to God, and like Jairus, we're waiting, and it seems like he's paying attention and helping everybody but us. We can't see his action in our life, and the situation is not getting any better. It can be challenging to trust that we haven't been forgotten, to trust in God's timing and hold on to our faith. And I don't say this flippantly. It can be hard to wait for God. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be needy. I don't want to be desperate, and I don't want to wait. I want to be independent, strong, and secure right now. Weakness is undesirable and unattractive in our world. And as followers of Jesus, we swim against the tide of our culture when we choose to be vulnerable in our need for God and to welcome other needy people in. And revealing our real needs is not without risk. Like Jairus, we may risk our social standing by revealing our need, or we'll be rejected by others in the community like the bleeding woman was. You know, fear of being exposed can keep us from the very things we need: God's love, a community's love, and grace. But as we see from the stories today, being needy is an entry point for his strength and love and freedom to enter our life. And so would there be any invitation from Jesus to you today as he kneels before you to bring your need to him and to other people? The third thing that I want to leave us with is we have a God who makes a place for us to belong. Jesus shows us something about our place in his family. It isn't dependent on our status or our position. Jesus is moved to compassion for Jairus, who has lots of status, but then he puts Jairus on hold to respond in compassion to the woman who has none. The status dynamic has been around since the dawn of creation. You can hear it in Genesis 3 when Satan tempts Adam and Eve. You know why God said not to eat that, right? Because then you'll be like him. You'll know what he knows. Did he really say you can't do whatever you want? That you can't have whatever you want? That guy is such a killjoy. The consequences of Adam and Eve's decision to listen to that voice and take what wasn't theirs to take splinters their relationship with God and with each other. And we experience those consequences today. The temptation to want everything, to have everything, to be a have rather than a have not, climbing over others to achieve status and position and power, even in small ways. But Jesus comes and he turns everything on its head. We observe how the outpouring of his compassion on Jairus and the woman, it levels them. The compassion comes and just levels everything, makes them equals in his family. We hear his frustration at the religious leaders, the ones who were meant to welcome in the weak and the weary and help them be at home in God's house. They've been the ones making it hard for the people to get close. But Jesus comes, and we read in Philippians that he, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, but he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Jesus' death on the cross, but also his servant-hearted actions in life, ushered in a new order. And on this first Sunday of Advent, we acknowledge his coming as the beginning of an upside-down kingdom, where the first is last and the last is first, and there's enough love to go around for everybody in the family. There's no need for status here. That kingdom is still breaking into the earth today. Now, the outpouring of compassion from heaven is available to each one of us right now. We have a place to belong. And do we know that? Our place with Jesus isn't secured by what we do or who we know or the names we can drop. It's secured by his compassion for us. And so I'd like to call the worship team to come forward now to lead us in a song of response to our passage today. And then we're going to turn our attention to the baptismal tank because of people in our community are going to be getting baptized. But let me just pray for us as we prepare to respond. You know, and if you sense God speaking to you from the message from today, or there are other things happening in your life that you would like prayer for, members of the prayer team would love to pray for you during this song of response. And again, at the conclusion of our service today, Gary and Renee are in the back, if that's right, and would love to pray for you. And let me just pray. Jesus, as we turn our attention towards you now, I ask that you would turn your attention towards us. Would you incline your ear towards us, even now, Lord? We thank you that these stories Mark captured have been preserved for us so that we might know you better and follow you more closely. Thank you that you listen to us. You don't mind it when we interrupt you. You welcome needy people like us. And you've given us a place in your house, in your family. And Jesus, I ask for anyone here today who feels broken in body or spirit, whether it's difficulties in life, circumstances, or relationships, or other unmet needs, would you come and help them? Would you show them again who you are? And please, do not delay.